Well, good morning, TNC family. On this second Sunday in September, I want to talk to you today from the scriptures about how to flourish. But I want to start with this. There's a Walmart very near my home, and two Saturdays ago, late morning, I went up to buy fresh fruit, donuts, breakfast bars, fruit juices, and waters for our church gathering on Sunday morning. And two Saturdays ago, there was something special about the trip because it was the first big Saturday of college football season. And this is the time of year people's passion surrounding college football is enormous, especially in the South. And pretty much every single aisle I went down, there was at least one person wearing a football shirt or jersey, a Roll Tide shirt, a War Eagle shirt, a Tiger shirt, an Orange Tennessee shirt, and of course, Georgia Bulldog shirts, caps, jerseys, socks. And in the parking lot, cars with Bulldog flags and bumper stickers. And it wasn't Sunday, but I also saw some NFL jerseys. I saw a Falcons shirt and a Cowboys shirt and a Tampa Bay shirt because it's the start of football season and expectations and excitement are high for all fans. And it got me to thinking, part of why football is so fun, especially this time of year, is we don't know how the season will end. I mean, if you knew before the season that your team would lose half of all its games and have no postseason prospects, you may be less interested in catching every game, watching every kickoff, every snap. Because there is actually joy in the not knowing. Or even just take one Saturday. If you knew for sure that your team would get blown out, lose like 49-3, you may not watch or plan your whole weekend around watching. Or you may not buy tickets and fly across country and pay for hotel accommodations. If you knew there would be an outcome like that. Because, in fact, part of a flourishing football season for a fan includes not knowing. Because it leads to football parties and laughter and food and cheering and hoping and longing and armchair quarterbacking. And it's in this faith, hope, and longing, and even struggling along the way, that the season has meaning and joy. Which should lead us to begin to think, hey, the flourishing life is not the same thing as knowing the result. Further, flourishing is not the same as a simple return on investment economic evaluation. This is why I would not leave my role as pastor here for more money there. Even if there was Hawaii with 200 grand a year, because the flourishing life isn't the same as where money is more and weather is better. Because the purpose and joy and friendships and fun and love I feel and have with you at TNC is through the roof, flourishing. And I've never known a couple to say, hey, we want to have children because it's fun or worth it or will give us more free time. No, you have a child because it makes your entire life richer, even if it makes your bank account poorer. I'm talking today about flourishing. And if you think about friendship and flourishing in the context of friendship, I wouldn't evaluate whether to invest in a friend based on how much did he do for me versus how much I do for him, because friendship can be viewed independently of how rewarding it is, like maybe just being a good friend is part of my calling and sense of purpose and meaning, and so I can flourish even when it isn't worth it. This is why many people go to church or investigate religion, not just because they think, oh, it'll be simpler to commit to a weekly spiritual routine or to arrange time and money around helping a broader community of folks. No. Usually it's because in life we want to flourish, which includes having purpose and meaning. We want to belong to something larger than ourselves. We want to matter. We want to think about things that will transcend us. And I'm just trying to make this larger case that at the heart of a life well lived, at the heart of being fully alive, at the center of deep flourishing is living and acting with purpose, meaning, dignity, integrity, and creative freedom to add beauty, make a difference, pursue ideas and dreams, no matter the cost and amid the uncertain outcomes. Because the flourishing life is way deeper than simple results and economic equations, which is why Jesus said things like Matthew chapter 16, the one who will gain their life must lose it. There is something about losing your life to the right people and ideas that results in flourishing, Jesus says. This is why James, the brother of Jesus, wrote in his letter, chapter 1, quote, "Count it all joy, brothers and sisters, when you face trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces faithfulness, and let faithfulness have its full effect, that you might be mature, lacking in nothing." In other words, the flourishing life, James says, comes from things like endurance and faithfulness. And the Apostle Peter writes in his letter, 2 Peter chapter 1, quote, "Apply to your life good character, spiritual understanding, alert discipline, passionate patience, reverent wonder, warm friendliness, and generous love. For if these qualities are yours and are increasing, you will be productive and fruitful." You'll flourish. Do you see it? Flourishing is deeper than outcomes of sporting events or SAT exams or office presentations or first dates. Flourishing is deeper than, did I get a ROI on that investment? Flourishing is what we were made for. So, let's talk for a few minutes about how to flourish. Let's talk for a few minutes about three aspects of pursuing the flourishing life. And I want to frame it this way in the context of what folks who flourish understand, what they know. And here's number one. Number one, folks who flourish understand every decision is a door. Every day is this opportunity to move toward flourishing. This is why if you want doors to open in your marriage, it's not mostly about taking that big second honeymoon trip to Italy. No, it's about today. I remember years ago now sitting down with a couple. They were sitting on the green couch at the church, and I was sitting on a brown sanctuary chair, and they were struggling in their relationship. And the guy said, "I just don't understand. We went on an awesome vacation together last summer, and I took her out to a super nice restaurant and booked a hotel room on Valentine's Day, and we had a huge birthday party for her." And then I asked him, "And what about between all of that? Like, did you serve her in some way last Sunday? Like, what is one thing specifically you do on an average Sunday that lets her know you are her friend and fan? And have you told her that her joy on Monday makes your whole week start better? And did you notice her haircut on Tuesday and her wisdom and work ethic on Wednesday and the way she does so many little things every day to make life better for everyone around her?" And I said to her, "And what about him? Do you notice and compliment him in the everyday moments? Because they're doors to a wonderful relationship. Do you talk about his sacrifice? Thank him for that solution. Compliment his sense of humor. Let him know you appreciate his desire to love you well and live each day in a way that honors your friendship." And My point is your daily decisions to do these things will open doors to all kinds of great stuff that a $5,000 trip to Italy could never do. Because what you do every day matters more than what you do once in a while. And every moment is an opportunity. Every decision is a door. Every text you send, every compliment given, every act of generosity, every faithfully fulfilled promise, every conversation. The great spiritual writer, some of you will know, lifelong pastor, Eugene Peterson, wrote many years ago now in an article for Leadership Journal, an article called The Ministry of Small Talk, in which he writes, quote, "If we avoid small talk, we abandon the very field in which we have been assigned to work. Most of people's lives are not spent in crisis," he writes, "not lived at the cutting edge of crucial issues. Most of us, most of the time, are engaged in simple routine tasks, and small talk is the natural language. And if we belittle it, we belittle how God most often wants us to extend his goodness in our lives. Every moment matters. Every decision is a door. This is why Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, take every thought captive to the ways of God. Because it's not just random or periodic thoughts that matter. It's every thought that matters. And Jesus says in Luke chapter 16, be faithful in little things, and then you will be given much. The small stuff is really big, Jesus says. And folks who flourish, they just don't think about the flourishing life as something you get later or you'll get after the season ends, if it happens at all. They understand that every decision is an opportunity to move toward flourishing. I wonder if you can identify flourishing decisions you've made in the last week. Because to be honest, most of the decisions to flourish don't require extensive research to figure out what they will be. Like, hey, should you get good sleep? That's a flourishing decision. Is the world made better through being stingy or generous? Do you think it's better to forgive people? Or in your experience, is life better when you hold on to bitterness and you nurse it and hold it close to your heart? Do you think it's better to be authentic or to be fake? Is it best to always think of yourself first or to think of the good of others? Is it best to go into every interaction as if you're the expert and the teacher, or to enter every interaction as if you are a learner and a student, humble and ready to expand your horizons? Is it better to make rushed judgments about people or to wait and ask questions and hear a bit more and figure out where they're coming from? Do you see what I'm saying, TNC? When you talk to folks who flourish, what you discover is they flourish because of how they view daily things like this, the daily moments, because they understand their doors to richer friendships and adding value and creating beauty and demonstrating love. And if you stack up a bunch of days of deeper friendships and enriching others and creating beauty and spreading love, you stack that up day after day, and pretty soon your life will be flourishing. Every day you can choose the life of flourishing because every decision is a door. Okay, number two. Folks who flourish understand pain is part of the process. Pain is part of the process. Or said another way, struggle is not an unwelcome part of flourishing. It's actually a key ingredient to flourishing. The Apostle Paul said it this way, Romans chapter 5, we rejoice in suffering, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope will not disappoint us because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who he has given to us. And TNC, there's something about risk and struggle and stretching, Paul says, that is directly linked to your human flourishing. And if you think about it, Let's think about it at the simplest of levels. It's actually why people play Wordle and do crosswords and spend hours writing and editing and editing and editing blogs and read do-it-yourself books and hike mountains every summer and run marathons and volunteer for work without pay and join the army when there's a war on. Because struggle, when it's in the service of an idea, a goal, is a key ingredient to flourishing. I remember a couple years ago, I read the book The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt by Edmund Morris. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 1980. Some of you know Roosevelt was the first U.S. president to ever ride in a submarine, to own a car, to have a telephone in his own home, to win the Nobel Peace Prize and the Medal of Honor. He was an author, rancher, conservationist, legislator, politician, soldier, governor, adventurer, and the youngest president in American history. But his life wasn't always easy. For example, when he was just 26 years old, his wife and his mother died on the same day, in the same home, different illnesses. He would write in his journal that day one sentence: "The light has gone out of my life." And it led to an era of introspection and reevaluation about his life and his passions and his loves. And shortly thereafter, Roosevelt volunteered to go to Cuba and fight in the Spanish-American War. And he formed a group of Rough Riders, a group of ranchers and indigenous Americans and some old Ivy League athletes from Harvard. And they sailed to Cuba and he led them into the battle for San Juan Hill. But there was a problem. They were at the bottom of the hill and bullets from Mauser machine guns were coming down at them from the top of San Juan Hill, and his unit was taking heavy losses. And at one point they came to a barbed wire fence, a fence he would need to cross in order to take the hill, but also a fence that once they crossed it was sort of like, there's no turning back now. And you see in the book, he has this moment of decision: turn back, return to the safety, or stand up, move forward, and fight for San Juan Hill. And the chapter is called The Wolf in My Heart. The wolf in my heart. Now think about that word picture. The wolf in my heart. Because he would later write about that, saying, quote, "At that moment, a wolf rose in my heart." A witness, in fact, said later that from the instant he stepped across the wire, he, quote, "became the most magnificent soldier I have ever seen." Because shells were exploding around him, even burning his skin, yet he pressed on. Because a stray bullet nicked his elbow, but he pressed on. Because there was insane noise and confusion and death, but he pressed on. Because he didn't stop until the battle was won. And now listen. For the rest of his life, he referred to that day, July 1, 1898, as the greatest day of his life. And from Mother Teresa, the wolf in her heart called her to serve the poor and the sick, and she went to Calcutta. And for Joan of Arc, the wolf in her heart called her to fight for independence, and she died a martyr. And for Rosa Parks, the wolf in her heart called her to simply refuse to move to the back of the bus. And it started a whole civil rights movement. And for Corrie ten Boom, it was to help Jews escape from the Nazis during the Holocaust. And for Jackie Robinson, one of the greatest baseball players of his time, the wolf in his heart called him to stand up for human and civil rights and the surrender of his personal right to fight back against racists in order to advance the greater cause. For our first president, George Washington, the wolf in his heart was the peaceful transition of power, to refuse to be America's new king when begged to run for office for a third term. And so he refused power. And what you notice in the lives of people with passion and purpose and a wolf in their heart, what you notice is that the wolf calls them to a deeper meaning and purpose that will almost always involve some struggle, some pain. And by the way, it's not that you only get like one wolf in your life. It's not that you only have one wolf in your heart in a lifetime. Sometimes your wolf is a wolf for a season, a wolf for an era, a wolf just to extend forgiveness, a wolf just to surrender your anger, a wolf to just support a great cause with enormous financial generosity. But here's the point. Folks who flourish know that the fulfilled life, the flourishing life, will almost always involve some version of, hey, there's sacrifice and humbleness and risk and stretching and pain, and it's not optional. It's the key ingredient in the flourishing. Pain is part of the process of anything related to flourishing. You want to flourish? Folks who flourish know every decision is a door. And folks who flourish know pain is part of the process. Which leads to number three, final one I want to talk about now. Number three, folks who flourish, they just understand my story is part of a larger story. Your story is part of a grander story. Now think about that, TNC. You are part of a larger narrative, which means you won't always know how the larger story will end up. I mean, think about the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis. His individual story is he doesn't always see the larger narrative while he's in the moment that he's in. Like when he's a kid in Canaan at age 17, Joseph's brothers hate him so much that they beat him half to death, throw him into a pit, and leave him to die. But then he ends up in Egypt as a slave, but then starts to turn his fortune around when he's falsely accused of rape, and he's falsely imprisoned, and then he's forgotten by a friend who promised to help him. But, and now let's fast forward his story, because at the end, he'll look back over all these painful episodes and he sees he was part of a grander story and that his individual story was part of a larger narrative. And this is just always how it is for folks who flourish. They begin to see that, hey, my story is part of a larger story. Esther, go before the king, save a nation. Joseph, stay with Mary despite the accusations. Mary, trust the words of God. You will raise the Messiah. Friends, there is no story that isn't linked to a larger story. Some of you know J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings trilogy. It's been in the news recently with Amazon Prime's new series centered on it. But I was thinking several days ago about one of the more quoted sections in Tolkien's second book in the trilogy, The Two Towers, where Samwise Gamgee and Frodo are entering into the most dangerous part of Mordor. It's a dangerous journey in general, and now they are especially filled with fear. And Frodo says, I don't like anything about this. But this is where our path has been laid. And Sam says, yes, we wouldn't be here at all if we'd known more about it before we started. Did you hear that? Because that's our lives, friends. So much of life, family, marriage, work, relationships, just being a human. Often if we knew where and what we were headed into, we would never say yes. Which would be a tragedy because we'd miss out on the flourishing life because we'd probably decline the trials and adventures if we knew about them ahead of time. And in the book, Sam goes on, quote, the brave things in the old tales and songs, Mr. Frodo, adventures as I used to call them, I used to think that they were things the wonderful folk of the stories went out and looked for because they wanted them, because they were exciting and life was a bit dull a kind of sport, as you might say. But that's not the way of it with the tales that really mattered, or the ones that stay in the mind. Folks seem to have been just landed in them, usually. Their paths were laid that way, as you put it, Frodo. But I expect they had lots of chances, like us, of turning back. Only they didn't. And if they had, we wouldn't know, because they'd have been forgotten. We hear about those who have went on, and not all to a good end, mind you, at least not to what folk inside the story, and not outside of it, call a good end. Sam goes on, I wonder what sort of tale we've fallen into. And that's the key, I think, TNC. I wonder, because you don't always know how things will turn out. Frodo responds, quote, I wonder, but I don't know. And that's the way of a real tale. Take anyone you're fond of. You may know or guess what kind of story it is, happy ending or sad ending, but the people in it don't know, and you don't want them to. And this is so powerful about our lives, friends, because we are the people in the story, and we don't always know how aspects of our story will end. And of course, before I make a decision, I want to know exactly how it will end. And in the middle, I want to make sure it's going to turn out well. And I pray that God will promise me that it will end well. But the cultivation of an interior life that flourishes almost requires that you do not know how your specific story will end. Instead, only that you know that you are part of a larger story and that your life matters. Now, you can't always control every aspect of your story, but the call of one who flourishes is to begin to see that the situation that you are in right now is part of a larger story, and what you do matters for the larger narrative. In the book, Sam says, as he's thinking about past heroes, quote, come to think of it, we're in the same story still. It's still going on. Do the great stories never end? No, says Frodo. They never end as stories, but the people in them come and go when their part has ended. And TNC, we are in the great story. The story that in the beginning God created, and it will have an ending. God will make all things new. And now we're in the middle of it, and we come and go, but the story goes on, and it has meaning and goodness, and we are called to flourish and to bring flourishing to it every day, embracing the wolf in our hearts and staying connected to one another and to the great one who launched the grand story and who is active in it and who will never leave us nor forsake us and who will one day come again and be with us in the renewed heaven and earth. Let's pray. God, I pray for every person listening now, because sometimes our path moves in places and in directions we would rather it not go. And so I pray especially for folks who are in these moments, that they would know that even there you come and say, I'll walk with you and bless you and bring you to a place of flourishing. God, help us be friends and family members and co-workers. Help us be a church that trusts you in our stories and in our struggles as we lean into the promise of the great story of humanity told in these scriptures. And now, may the Lord bless you and keep you, make his face to shine upon you, and be gracious to you. Turn his face toward you and give you peace.